technologies are getting far more advanced. In terms of our own report here, CSIR produced a report that says in South Africa, renewable energy is 40% cheaper than coal. Now, I mean, that is quite interesting. And just this week, I think, globally, renewable energy finally, in terms of the study, renewable energy is generating 50% of global electricity, according to them. 50%. So that 100% renewable vision that NGOs and others have had is truly possible. And we need to look at that. One of the things that I think is important in this is that it's not just the formal energy market that we must look at, but again, the role of international development within civil society, quite frankly. Many of you would have heard the Direct Invest movement, the work that they've been doing. This is about us being reliant on coal and coal becoming, sorry, it's just not going to be the most popular form of generating electricity soon. It is a huge movement globally and in this country will grow stronger and stronger that is really pushing for an end to coal. All fossil fuels, but for an end to coal. We can't be caught off guard. We know we are dependent on coal. So when we talk about transitioning, the just transition, we have to be starting now with all the key players, talking about that most important thing, how, when, you know, we can actually shift away from coal. That conversation has to be had, and I'll tell you some of the thinking around it. We are not going to deal with the domestic context. But I did want to raise this particular graph. The Paris Agreement is adopted. We're really happy about it. You know, it's of course been good. People have been working for years and years. Julie and Maitella and Alf and others have been in that process for a very long time. So we're excited that there's an agreement globally. But I wanted to just let you know what the reality is about what we forget. So on that graph, that red line are our current INDCs. Right? The global INDCs. The things that countries have submitted to say, these are the things we're going to be doing in terms of action. That includes South Africa. And that takes us on a path to 3.5 degrees. In the adaptation space, and this department has done really good work, you can imagine 3.5 degrees. Globally for Africa and for South Africa. What that means? It's 5 degrees, right? We're on that path. And this is of the governments that committed to a 2-degree scenario. So can you imagine that big? That curve goes down sharply, the 2-degree curve. We have to transition to that very quickly. And that time for that is going to have to start close to 2025, right? That's the challenge we're dealing with. That is the action gap. That's the action gap. And so, we need to talk about how South Africa contributes to bending that curve. And in all due respect, South Africa is greater than the INDCs. I think we have to also talk about how South Africa gets to the lower end of the range and not the top end of the range. So, but that's how we plan for in the transition. We might surprise ourselves that we can do things, bring emissions down more quickly. The plan, Jefferson has a vision for 2030, that, I'm sorry, there's a lot of words on the page. But I'm sure people have received this, but it's in the plan. It's just a repeat of what we say in the plan, what that end state in 2030 should look like. But then we also start, oh, I'm not moving the button. This is the okay. The transition to, yeah. So the transition to this low-carbon economy, as everybody has already said, in South Africa and even globally, it's going to be complex. It's not easy. And the research that the ERC has just done around these kinds of issues and policy and how it plays out in terms of implementation is something that we obviously can learn from. All the reasons for why it would be complex in this country, we are a coal-dependent country. Our CO2 emissions are high. We're in the top 20. In the world, we are, we have, of course, as I said, an unacceptably high levels of poverty and inequality. So there's a complex basically to ensure, in fact, the safety and security of all our people in South Africa, but in the world as well. So what we have to do, therefore, as a planning commission is tasked with doing that. In fact, all of us, the plan is a plan for the country. We should be putting the objectives of eradicating poverty and reducing inequality at the center, in fact, at the front of our transition plan. So anything we do related to how we will build a low-carbon, climate-resilient future must have this as a key and core objective. So what we have done in the plan says, though, is propose the adoption of a carbon budget approach. Now, this is not, I must be clear because I think it's confusing, but this is not the carbon budget that the department is busy negotiating with companies, but it is taking a macro view of the carbon, the remaining carbon budget that South Africa would have as a country based on your peak plateau decline trajectory. So everything under that line, we would assume is the carbon budget, and I think EOC has done some work around what that implies for energy, right? 14 gigatons left by 2050. But if you take not beyond just energy, then I'm not sure what those things are. I'm sure the department should say that. Now, if you have that amount of carbon left, surely how we use that carbon is fundamentally a decision-making process that has to be inclusive and transparent. It cannot be up to a department or two, together with one set of social partners, to negotiate the carbon, how we use the carbon budget in the country. But we have to decide, based on our limited carbon budget, whether we are going to prioritize social development, for example. Are we going to start spending the carbon budget on actually dealing with poverty, providing all the social services that's needed, and that includes, of course, low carbon things like public transport, etc., etc. So the point I'm trying to make, Chairperson, is that the carbon budget and how we share it, what we prioritize, what we spend our money on, etc., cannot be something that is happening between certain players in the country. It is a conversation that has to be done with the nation, as a nation. This is our future, you know? So, and we have enough examples of this nation talking together. Okay, because there are going to be winners and losers in this transition. We mustn't pretend it's going to be a rosy path. There are going to be winners and losers, and how best do you manage those who are going to be losing, except through inclusive, participatory, highly engaged processes. The losers will be toy-toying like hell if they weren't in this decision-making process from day one. And if fees must fall, if that movement is what it is today, can you imagine what it would look like when you're dealing with the future of all vulnerable people in this country? So, for me, the big question for all of us would be, this remaining carbon budget that we have, and this is like a limited carbon budget, do we spend it on the public good versus private interest? I'm challenging us, right? This is a challenging question. Do we use our remaining carbon budget on private interest? Maybe the iron, what's the thing called, iron triangle? Interest or the public good? I'm putting that out as a challenging question so far. We've also identified, of course, some of those challenges in this colloquium already. One of the big things that constantly bothers me, and it's really interesting now speaking to people who are already in the space, but if we get out of this room and we get out of the conversations with people who are in the environmental sector and in the climate sector, you will constantly hear the story. But we need to develop. I'm sure even in Parliament, Jefferson, people constantly say, oh, no, talk to me about the environment because we need to develop. And there's this notion global examples of where decoupling has worked, but we cannot say that our right to development in this country gives us the right to pollute. Because polluting now, we have global atmosphere. Polluting now, in one country, the pollution doesn't have a little box. It's the global atmosphere. It is the global commons that will be impacted. So if we carry on polluting, others in the rest of our region, especially, are more vulnerable, will be impacted on. So I just want us to think about this notion of development, and we have to challenge our own notion of development. We've already spoken about the lack of integration and synergy in policy and implementation, and I think we've already had a conversation about stakeholder vested interests. Now, vested interest isn't just the private sector thing. There's all kinds of vested interests. When I led the process, for example, in the first round to do when we were developing the plan, and you remember when we got the stakeholders in a room together, if you have government, labor, civil society, and business in the room together, they turn it into a negotiation. Nobody was willing to take their hats off and do this in the interest of the nation. What must we do with climate change? They got into a negotiation. So all of them were against government. At least government is the stakeholder that gets all the punches. But then labor is against business, and civil society is just against everybody. So that kind of approach to planning for our future, a transition, is not going to be helpful. We have to get social partners out of that vested interest, constituency interest approach to planning in the future. And then the other challenge, of course, is trade-off. So what are we going to discuss when we... who's going to make those decisions about trade-offs? It cannot be government alone with those involved. This, I want to argue all of these big questions, what we're spending our money on now, on energy, for example, which will lock us in to a particular future, is a conversation that we all need to have. So if that IRP comes out on the 24th of December, it's a problem, right? Because government likes to do that. On the 24th of December, the big documents come out, and everybody's on holiday, and you wake up the next time in January next year, then it's all done and dusted. And it's going to happen with this. There'll be big trouble. The energy stuff is going to cause big trouble in the country. So there are largely unresolved issues, which I will not go through, Chairperson, that relate to planning for the transition. But what I do want to quickly tell you is that the chapter in the plan right now was really a peg in the ground. You know, it was too, the time that we did this plan, it was too early for having the planning conversation, the real detailed planning conversation. So what we're planning to do in the second commission now is to run a process of getting the key social partners into a year-long exercise looking at the best pathway to transition. And when we say the best pathway, that is to maximize the objectives of achieving the objectives of reducing poverty and inequality, as well as reducing emissions to the levels, to the PPP and lower levels possibly. So that is going to be a year-long process. It will be a very small in-room process with coming out of the room public engagement as well. So watch out for that. We're putting out the terms of reference soon, probably on the 24th of December. We'll do this process next year. And I'm hoping that there are many players who are here today also will be invited into the process as well, but also to be part of the broader public processes. And what we'd like to do with the outcomes of that year-long process, hopefully, is to make this one of the, if it's consensus, to build that consensus into a social compact or contract. Maybe take it formally through NEDLAC, for example, and get that to be one of the first big social compacts in the country. Now, Chairperson, I did want to talk about the role of the portfolio committee. And having listened to the conversation earlier about members of honourable members who have raised the issue of this must be at the local level and the grassroots level, etc. I want to argue that actually the best placed people in the country to make climate change and the discourse and the work around the transition to climate change a real bottom-up process is you, the members of Parliament. I would urge that parliamentarians, through their work in Parliament, their work in the portfolio committee, and their work in their constituencies, actually make climate change an important bottom-up issue for everybody to engage. So that's the first thing. That's the role. Secondly, is to build transparency, to actually have more and more of these kinds of engagements, but not just to have a conversation, but when the real decisions happen, to invite people in. Those IOC have public hearings that invite everybody into the conversation, interrogate the modeling exercises, and allow us all to interrogate it as well. Don't just take the figures and the numbers from those who generated it and put it through some modeling machine. Please get us all into the conversation. And then, finally, is to have this discussion about the transition. Host those conversations as Parliament. It would be really, really great to have Parliament actually take ownership of planning for a transition to a low-carbon climate facility. Because you reaching, you can reach everybody. And those who don't want to come, you can simply in the next chairs. I think we have those powers. So I personally think Chairperson is great to be in this colloquium. I think utilize the power that you have as Parliament and as parliamentarians, and please, we are all here, your hands and feet, to support you in the work you do, and I want to end by thanking you for your commitment and dedication to helping to address what is one of the biggest global crises that we're facing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jasmine, for a very passionate input. I can feel and see the passion in how you present the issues that they are dear to your heart. Certainly, we take the challenge that you are giving us as a portfolio committee and a parliament. And indeed, this is exactly what we want to do. We want to be relevant to the issues that are facing the people out there. And hence the idea to begin with this colloquium. We may go into something else. The idea is to follow up the challenges that you have articulated for us. Mike is not going to be able to come back. He went to pick up something. Visa. So he's still on a long queue. He sent a message to say he won't be able to come back, judging by the queues there. So we will schedule some other day where we can interact with him. But for now, let's take South African Water.
Implementing agency of the department. So we don't
comfortable with the department. We worked with the department. You have seen that the department was talking on national strategies, national framework, and then as an implementing agency, we are going to go down to the level that goes closer to implementing and also closer to the people. Our mandate is from 2001. It's a public food service and commercial services. And then in terms of the warnings, we are authoritative voice of weather-related warnings. Members, the vision of Weather Smart, what I would like to share here is that there are roles that have been defined for different organizations. So in terms of weather, climate and related, we're supposed to disseminate information. I'll give an example of warning information. And then in terms of information getting to the people and how it is being used, then another role player is doing that job. But we say we need an end-to-end system. So we should disseminate information and collaborate to ensure that the information is received and is being used. So we can only be effective to the vulnerable people at grassroots when we collaborate. Here I'm just highlighting areas of the South African Weather Service. I'll just indicate here in terms of training, we're a regional training center, training beyond the borders, including the Middle East. So far we have trained in that area. And then in terms of the aviation, we need, we're trusted with safety, and they were recognized globally, and also we're being now engaged in discussion of being a regional hazardous aviation center. If that succeeds, that means we would provide aviation services to other countries. And in terms of the marine services, we are responsible for the second biggest marine area in the world, second to the US, so that is a huge responsibility. Also, we're a regional specialized meteorological center, providing severe weather guidance for focus products to SADC on a daily basis. But I want to end this slide by pointing here under climate services, we are busy with the department is developing a national framework for climate services, which is also key in responding to climate change, climate variability. As officials, we have already identified a need to have a robust discussion around data governance if we are to be successful in responding to climate variability, climate change issues, more especially looking at what the National Framework for Climate Service would need. This is just the distribution of the infrastructure share. I'm not going to talk to that, but we've got a better coverage in the continent. We've got strategies that we've tried to create as well, responding to the climate change and climate variability. Weather ready nation is what has informed the vision of the weather smart nation, so that you provide an end-to-end solution. So our value chain is data collection, processing, data management, value add, dissemination. So there's an arrow that is missing there, Honorable Chair, which should talk to the data reaching the end user, data reaching the communities there. So that's the area that we still need to figure out how to be effective in terms of the collaboration, because that area needs serious collaboration. We've got about 154 years data. And we're also custodian of National Climate Database. So, Chair, the data is there. So we need to add value to the data as various sectors and various organizations. Also, in terms of climatic means, we can use that data and add value and perform what is listed below there, Chair, which I'm going to talk to you later as well. So adding value to the data, we can also give farmers or users the risk associated with wet and dry spells, for example, at a given length, and also if the person should plant A,
As we know now, we predict that with time there will be late onset of rainfall. So that information can be used. And also the interpretation of this above normal, normal below normal rainfall forecast or temperature forecast. So we've got applications that can assist to quantify such information for water management, for example, and also for food security. This is just one example, as you can see, Chair, if you don't use relevant information, you will see that you are taking that means there. But then if you take into account the information, the meteorological, meteorological information, you can see your typical means that you will use. And this also goes with our planning, honorable members. I've got an example of a bridge in Lipala that I normally pass. That bridge is no more there, and that bridge is always taken down by flood. But then when we construct that bridge, we didn't take into account to what was it that took away this bridge. So we need to use this information for our planning. This is trying to illustrate the forecasting time scale for less than an hour, where the lead time is a challenge. And that is where you get your hailstorms, it's where you get your tornadoes within less than that hour. And also it's sharp, indicating that it's where you've got a high confidence level in terms of the predicted information, but also it's where you've got high level of accuracy. But the challenge is lead time. So if your disaster management plan at local level, at municipality level, are not robust, you will miss that accuracy. And then as it opens up, it shows that the uncertainty level is increased. So that means the confidence level is increased. It's very important to predict, to interpret that forecast information, because a forecast can be wrong. So we need to know when we use it for decision making. So what is important is, how high is my confidence level to this forecast? Can I rely on it? And then the answer is that almost certainly, or the answer is that, it's doubtful, but there's a likelihood that it could happen. So then you assess the situation, you make a decision. I'll just give you an example now about the predictions for this coming summer. A few months ago, we had a high level of uncertainty. So as we speak now, we've moved to moderate level of certainty, that there's a chance that we'll receive above normal rainfall in the early summer, that means November, December. So we should be happy now. We are moving from high level of uncertainty to moderate level of uncertainty. So we'd like to move to high level of certainty, to high confidence for that. So, but then we should be cautious as we make decisions, because there is that uncertainty level. The data from the satellite is very important, members. As you can see here, the satellite data is showing the displacement of rain during the El Nino period. That is, it's pushed far east and far northeast, and then South Africa has got this high pressure, which results in dominating subsidence of air. We need upward movement of air to get the rain. But then I'm demonstrating this to show that your numerical weather prediction models would have predicted this situation. Then now you've got satellite data to validate. So then if this high pressure is at the same position that was predicted by the numerical weather prediction model, you know, many days ago or many months ago, then your confidence level is high that whatever is happening, I should trust, because the observations from the satellite are showing that the models are handling the situation in a good manner. This is drought monitoring tool. So this one is showing the drought frequency median. So if you see the yellow and red, so that means the frequency is high. So you can see your northeastern, your Limpopo and Mpumalanga, and you've got high frequency in terms of a drought, looking at the median. But at the same time, when you look at the severity, you see Mpumalanga is still common there, and then some eastern part of Limpopo. But Mpumalanga is common for drought frequency, is common for severity, and then it's also a bit common for the intensity. So that is the kind of information that is you are using data to see exactly what is happening currently. And then again now, we have initiated your models with your data to look at the future projections. As you can see now that the rainfall onset is going to delay. So we expect the rain to come late, but to also terminate quicker. So then when you are deciding what crops to plant, you must know that you need crops that need or that can survive a shorter duration of rainfall. But again, you are seeing here is that dry spell duration is projected to increase. So we are expecting to have longer drought periods with time. So also in terms of water management, looking at the dam levels at the moment, we should be having our long-term plan now. So this is just showing what would happen if there would be no mitigation is taking place. Definitely the warming that was also demonstrated there for the future is going to take place. So this is just applications that were produced. I'm not going to dwell on that, honorable members. This is a typical example. I've just taken two provinces. This speaks to about national adaptation strategy, looking at the sector, you know, which is more inclusive. And then now, as an implementing agency, we are able to look at parameters like your temperature, like your rainfall, to say, let's look at this province of Eastern Cape. If we've got aggressive mitigation, what is going to happen in terms of warming? So we can actually go down to district level and even go down to municipality level so that as the municipalities are planning, are using the information, knowing to what are the future scenarios that are being predicted for that particular municipality. But in terms of these parameters, the rainfall tends to we have high level of uncertainty as we are working on the scenario. So this is just an example of the Free State. So I've used two provinces, but we can do at district level and also at the municipality level. So that's the conclusive remarks, Chair, is that we can provide sector-specific products and services, but also for municipalities, advisories. We have seen the advisory for the drought early last year, but then how much we have used that for our planning. I'll summarize and end there, honorable members. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Some of it was highly technical. Because in the main, the weather service, they deal with data, they are scientists. So the level of detail is quite intense. But thank you very much for demonstrating to us what weather service is capable of doing. That's that. Honorable members, guests. As I said, Professor Mark is not coming back, but his presentation, the service presentation. So we are going to find space where we can be able to engage with this. Those are the two presentations from Daphne and from Mr. Ndaba. Good news. Now, we sometimes, you know, when you're becomes unfair to you because people are looking at their watches and they want to go. And it's also grave, yes, Hashem. But can we get fewer probably 10 minutes, engage, and then close the session, hopefully at 3:10. I saw a hand here, Honorable Makubela, just close to the, just direct to the point. Yeah.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think it's more a grievous session than Cape Town Friday afternoon. But I just want to say, I mean, I agree completely with everything that's been said, as I always do, you know, climate change is not, I always say this internally as well, it's not an environmental problem, it's a sustainable development problem. And it's a wicked problem because it's not something that has a single solution or a solution that only one party can resolve. And I think what happens is when you try and resolve the problem, you have unintended consequences. And I think poverty is one of those. So I think, I mean, the chapter in the NDP talks exactly about all the things we need to address, but I think we need to get to the how. How we address those things is very important. Because if I give you an example, and Tasneem can respond, but I'm not asking for an answer right now, is that if we've done some modeling that we presented on Tuesday as well. And if you look at net zero emissions, in the next decade, we would have to close half the collieries in the country if we get to net zero emissions, because we're going to stop, obviously, using fossil fuels. So we all want to go towards a zero, a lower carbon emission future. But as you know, the coal mining industry employs most unskilled labor in the country. So that is one of the unintended consequences that we're going to have to deal with, and I think it's a very difficult problem, which is why I'm saying I'm not looking for solutions, but it's something we obviously cannot sit as one entity and resolve. So I think Tasneem's point about us getting together and talking about this nationally and driven by Parliament is an excellent point, because those are the kind of issues we're dealing with, and that is why it's called a wicked problem.
Thank you very much.
Hello, Thanks, Chair, and thanks to the presenters, both of them. Just to say that probably the issue raised earlier on the other presentation of the session, that we must take on board various anxious was projected well during this SOPS presentation that we may need everybody involved in taking into consideration particular issues of or issues that affect the poor, poverty, whatever, of their vulnerability and so on. I think that's good to hear. Just to understand now that you're posing the issue that the issues in terms of how we can resolve issues of climate change, that it needs the society, the nation at large to be involved. Particularly as we develop the pathways emanating from the NDP. Just to understand whether this is a collective or something that is shared within commissioners as the development of the NDP, or is something that you are opposing or you feel strongly as an individual and therefore it should be combated. Just for us to understand how we take that matter forward. Secondly, shared to the resource. Now we have got a country, as a country, we are not hit with this drought. The issue is whether you were able to project this some time back, that we shall be in this kind of a situation and therefore need to be better prepared, whether in terms of farmers or anyone, or perhaps put differently. How far into the future can you forecast or project that the situation will be like?
you, Chair. Introduction, my name is Jean Pacer from Sasol. So just two comments. The first one, to just him, I think, is talk about climate change. It is pretty much the same as climate change being understood as a common problem internationally. The only way we know how to deal with it is through a multilateral process. I think the process is no different domestically, because if you really want to do something positive and mitigate against climate change in South Africa as a country, you need to be able to involve all of the parties. So we pretty much support that approach that has been outlined. I think we also mustn't underestimate the particular challenges that South Africa has, which is also slightly different than what you have in other countries. For example, one, and the name is already articulated very well, the fact that we have coal as our main source of supply of energy. While we have renewable energy and some gas, it is less than 6% of the total energy mix. So how do we move from that less than 6% to higher than that percentage? And we only do that together. I think, Chair, the second one, and while I can only speak on behalf of Sasol, but I'm sure that if I look at Andrew, you'll probably agree with me, that there is potentially a perception that business as a whole is less, what's the word, willing to do something about climate change. And I think it would be a great opportunity if you provide us an opportunity to come and present to you what we are doing, what we have done, both from a mitigation perspective and both from an adaptation perspective, to give a view that we actually don't need to be always to be encouraged to do something. We sometimes do something because we believe it's the right thing to do. That is the request I'll make to the portfolio committee. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that. I think it's good to hear that this business is doing something out of their own initiative. It would have been better if had we known about the offer so that we invite you also to come and present here. But unfortunately, it's we'll consider it when we do another one next time. Quite clearly, the choices are tough. Very tough choices that humanity is facing now. Whether do we continue along this trajectory that we have been going through, this path, which we know this path is going to lead us to destruction. Because it's not going to be sustainable. The effect of climate change, people thought it's going to happen towards 2030, but we're feeling them now as we speak. As we speak, there are extreme weather conditions that we'll be subjected to. And I think there's a slide from the weather service to say if you don't do something, it's going to be all red at some point. So in the choices that we are faced with, whether do we put aside the people and their health and the sustainability of the country on the other hand, or we put the cost and the profit and other things on the other hand. So those are the choices. Obviously, I don't believe that there is a choice to be made between economic growth and sustainable development, because the two can coexist. You can have a situation where you transit towards a low carbon economy but still have rapid economic growth and development. It's possible, according to me. I've read some people who are very radical about ESCO and probably about Sasol, who are saying that there must never be any investment in anything that involves coal. I'm sure you have heard about that. But if we are going to transit from coal and carbon emissions, we must stop any further investment in coal now. Very radical. A very radical views about that. So I'm sure
That's the call that Tasneem is making, that let's have conversation, let's convene everybody. And I think this is a role that Parliament can do, and we're beginning to do that. Even when we'll be processing policy issues, legislative issues, I think we will continue to do that. Tasneem, just a few seconds or a few minutes, respond, and then source.
Thanks, Jacob. And I think there is just one question, and that was whether the views that I shared were shared by the Commission. Was that the question? Well, the slideshow that I've presented is based on what the work that we do at the Commission. The fact that we're going to be continuing the pathway work, where we get the one that I spoke about as the next step, that is fully endorsed by the full Commission. It went through the plenary of the Commission. The Minister's actually quite supportive. He thinks it's a special project. So it's gone through the working group of the thing, of the Commission, and we plan to dovetail our work with the work that the Department is doing as well. So, yes, it is a commissioning. Views on energy choices, if I've expressed any, I don't think I was very explicit about it, but certainly some of those views would certainly not be a commission-wide, because we, you know, the plan is clear about the choices, the energy mix, and we can have those debates. I think it's still up for debate. We are, as this new commission, we're reviewing the energy piece exactly, because there's been so many developments since the release of that report and now. So we're going to see that energy is one of the big pieces that the new commission is looking at today.
Yes, the rest were just a comment. Mr. Will help me.
Maybe when I was saying it, that's the good news.
Yeah, I don't want to change your opinion.
Okay. Thank you, Bernardo. In terms of predictions of drought that started last year, summer season, yes, they were predicted. Actually, last year during winter, the confidence level was very high. So there was an official advisory which was more explicit. That was issued in August as an update of the other advisories. But the one of the focus was explicit and was reflecting the high confidence level predicting for the following summer. And it was reflecting the fact that 2014, the northern and the northeastern parts were already dry, so there were flat, actually drought areas already. So that those parts are going to even be enhanced. For the future, already we are giving projections for the next 10 years. We are giving projections for towards the end of the century. For planning purposes, the information is actually now available for even longer planning. Like in my presentation, I was saying we are projecting that there will be late onset of rainfall. We are actually experiencing it now. So that means in terms of observation, the late onset has actually started. So then we need to monitor whether late onset, they are coming very late,
okay.
The summer rainfall. Normally in South Africa, either end of July or somewhere in August, you get those weather systems that will rain over a longer period, day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, affecting the whole country. We didn't experience that this year. We didn't experience that last year. During June, July, August, in the Sotho Mountains, those Sotho Mountains would get snowfall, which when they melt, they go and fill the river. That didn't happen last year. That didn't happen this year. So those are the observations that we need to make, because the water shortage now is actually even caused by not for those areas not to get the snowfall that used to fill up the river. So then if we are having now going to say, use this example and say be active to that. They will monitor for a longer period. But having that information in mind, I think us as ordinary human beings, let's look at the science information and interpret it using what we experience.
Okay. Global warming is a reality, I think. It's no longer a question. I think there's consensus among the climate change scientists that whatever that we're experiencing now is as a result of that. So there is no light there to say, but is it really happening? It is happening, and it is for us to play our part. There are just a couple of things that emerge. So what we will do, we will together with the committee secretary, just go through the notes and probably communicate what emerged as issues. One of which I think was the delay in the regulations, which we need to look at so that can finalize and process them. But the other issues, I think we were able to cover them. Just in closing, I think we have done what we set out to do, to have this thing as a learning platform. I must thank very much the University of Cape Town for the presentation that they've made. Of course, the Prof agrees that you will share with us the outcome of the final research paper. As I said, I really want to understand the relationship between the triangle and because you just brought it in the middle of your presentation. It didn't show what exactly where does it come from, what are the underlying assumptions, what supports the theory and so forth. So I'm sure we'll do that, but we'll interact from the outcome of that research paper. But we thank you very much for coming. And the department, the minister, Judy, as always, we appreciate your presence in our community. And the few honorable members, including the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Agriculture, the Forests and Fisheries, thank you very much for coming. Unfortunately, some of our members decided to have other things and they left, so if we're keeping the register properly a week to get salary, they shouldn't be receiving it. Must talk to colleagues to get that back. But anyway, thank you very much, all of you, for coming. We really appreciate it. We're going to have another one next year. Not on climate change, but on something else, because as you said from the beginning, we would like Parliament to create a platform for society to engage on the topical issues, so we will continue to do that. Thank you very much.